Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for Beyond the Mekong, which is broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today, again, is Paul Greening, who has become a regular on this program, and we'll be talking about Myanmar and looking for another update. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Luke. It's always good to have you getting the news out on Myanmar.
It's interesting what comes out, what gets printed, and what's actually going on. They're often three very different things.
Exactly.
Anyway, down to business. I think the most interesting topic, barring the fighting coming out of Myanmar at the moment, is Dawei, where the Russians are offering the junta two nuclear reactors. They are small, each one capable of producing 55 megawatts for a total capacity of 110 megawatts, but nevertheless, there's been a lot of fighting in that region. The military is opening its arms and saying it will build a special economic zone, an SEZ. The Russians have just been down there looking at where they're going to put those reactors, which, as the wind blows, is only 400 kilometres thereabouts from Bangkok. What are they thinking?
Well, that's the thing. I'm not sure if this is actually going to happen or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's been online showing that he's developing the country, etc., with nuclear power. But if you look, Dawei, I've been through Dawei a number of times. There's heavy fighting there, yep. And the resistance, the Karen National Liberation Army, is making big inroads. They've just taken the border area there, and they're going to put their own customs and their own immigration there. That's called Tiki. Tiki was taken just last week.
Right.
Totally taken. So they've got that. So the border, very close to Dawei, is already being taken by the resistance, and they're taking more and more. Are they really going to build nuclear power on the border when the resistance is close to taking it? Also, another big problem, of course, who's going to trust the junta, who are totally inefficient, ridiculous, yeah, with nuclear power? You know, even if they don't try and make a dirty bomb out of it or something stupid, you know, they're not the maintenance, looking after it. Wouldn't trust them at all. You know, mm-hmm. This is if it does happen, is a disaster waiting to happen.
Right, and the Thai authorities have been rather quiet, even lame about this. One would think that they would be at least knocking on the doors of the junta and asking what's going on.
Well, I think you have one or two independent MPs that are making a bit of a fuss, mm-hmm, concerning Burma. I think Pattai, the sort of ruling party, has other serious issues, internal issues, that they're dealing with.
Yep.
And from my experience, the Thais don't tend to work proactively. It tends to be more retroactively.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll wait until something happens and then they'll react.
Right.
They're doing this on the border as well, yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned the fighting in and around Dawei, which is down in the southeast on, well, I guess you'd call it a west coast in the southeast.
Yes.
Mon territory, where the communists, if I remember correctly, announced they were going to rejoin the resistance.
Yes, yes.
The fighting situation, can you give us a broad update? What's happening across the country?
At the moment, the monsoon's about to come. That will change things to some extent. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, the resistance is certainly making strong inroads. It's very clear that the military, the Myanmar military, has got nothing really except air power.
Mm-hmm.
And they've spent, on dropping bombs, they spent 66% more this year than last year. So they're getting the money and they're spending more and more on arms.
Right.
Yeah, they have various types of air power, of course. They've moved on from having just the jets, which are extremely expensive. They've now got paragliders, where they can shoot from a machine gun and drop bombs in a very sort of primitive way.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they've got drones. They've got the usual agricultural-type Chinese drones, but also they've got a lot now of more sophisticated military-grade drones, which have come from Russia, with, mm-hmm, Russian technicians have trained them on that. They'll work in the monsoon as well. All of this is air power. They're not aiming this air power at resistance groups. It's at people. It's at villagers. This is aimed at terror.
Mm-hmm.
They want to terrorize the people, and that some of their thinking is they terrorize the people enough, the people put pressure on the ethnic armed organizations to actually, you know, call a ceasefire or actually give up fighting and give up their arms.
Right, I haven't seen any indication that that's going to happen.
It's not going to happen. You look at what's happening historically in other armed conflicts. Mm-hmm. You keep bombing, torturing, killing the people.
just makes them angrier.
It makes them angrier and they go for revenge, yeah. And it's not changing.
I did see a report, complete with photos and videos, quite recently, that the resistance had shot down a helicopter and what appeared to be a jet. Can you confirm that?
Yes. No, it was a helicopter they shot down.
Right.
I think they probably used a man pad, which is surface to air. They put with it an old picture of a man pad. And this was the KIA, the Karen Independence Army.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been rumoured or known to actually have man pads. Not many, but they have. So they did shoot down a helicopter. Another one they shot at had an emergency landing.
Right.
So one was shot down in the forest and they found the pieces. And so the,
there was two helicopters?
Two helicopters.
Okay, because it was a mangled wreck. We couldn't quite make out what the second one was. But
one actually did survive and it was an emergency landing. The other was shot down.
Right, but this is quite something I know.
It's unusual.
Karen were celebrating over that one, and perhaps it might be a sign of what comes next.
Exactly. And if they have more man pads. Basically, with the air power,
mm-hmm.
you can either shoot it down,
yep.
or you hit the airfields. Unfortunately, the planes are under strong reinforced concrete bunkers.
To be expected.
As you would expect, but they have to come out occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
Or you aim at the pilots.
Right.
You aim at the pilots. The pilot in Sagang bombed a school and killed 24 children recently,
mm-hmm.
they published his name. They know his name.
Right.
So they go after the pilots, they'll go after their families, or certainly intimidate the families.
Sad, but anyway.
That's probably what's going to happen, but yeah. especially the pilots. So you've got the pilots, you've got shooting them down and hitting the runways, hitting where the aircraft are stored, etc., which they're doing as well. And they're getting more and more able to do that
mm-hmm.
because they get more sophisticated weapons, the resistance are. Why? Not because they can produce some of the sophisticated ones, because they're harvesting them. Like you see all the bases right. on the border, and they've almost all taken now on the border with Thailand, the KNU, Karen National Union, has taken most of the bases.
That's giving them access to surface-to-air missiles.
Not that. More mortars.
Okay.
But mortar shells of 120 millimetres.
Right.
Those will go 10 kilometres.
Okay.
And they're accurate. Rather than the handmade ones that they're making, which they shoot in the general direction.
Mm.
But these are pretty accurate.
It's interesting. I was just thinking to quickly digress, but it was the American introduced surface-to-air missiles in Afghanistan, which enabled the Mujahideen to shoot down the Russian helicopters, which completely changed the course of the war and led to the Russian withdrawal. It's perhaps we're nearing the start of the end.
Yeah, in America, of course, you had someone called Charles something who was actually pushing this. He's the senator that pushed it.
Right.
America now is not really interested, so they're not going to
do it's
that.
A different story. But, okay, the fighting Rakhine State seems pretty much under the control of the Arakan army, though the Sitwe still hasn't fallen, correct?
Well, for the Chinese, Chopyo is more important because that is the end point for the Belt and Road from Kunming, coming all the way through.
Now,
there's heavy fighting there, very heavy fighting there now.
Right.
China's playing an interesting role. I thought maybe China would flip and start supporting the resistance because they can see the resistance is going to win. Yeah. Arakan army is going to win, but they're not. They're putting more money and more arms, generally, in the hands of the Myanmar military. But they're also talking to the Arakan army as well, just in case. They cover the odds. They cover the odds.
Now, I think the last time we spoke, the Chinese had just put their first 50 boots on ground to guard their oil and gas assets. Since then, obviously, the Mandalay earthquake, which we'll get there shortly. But have we seen any more troops put on ground by the Chinese? What's their status?
I haven't heard of that, but very interestingly, concerning the gas pipelines, this was like off limits. Mm. No one wanted to upset the gas pipelines. Just in the last week, they took out two military bases. They couldn't keep it, stay in the military base because of airstrikes, but they took them out. These military bases were guarding the pipeline, which shows that the junta can't protect Chinese assets. And China will understand that. And all the ethnic resistance, ethnic armed organizations are saying, and NUG, we will not harm Chinese assets. They're trying to reassure them of that. So with that, and clearly the junta can't protect it.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance at least.
And that's what China would prefer, military, easy to deal with an authoritarian regime. But Its main interest is just economic. And, right. and it sees Myanmar as a resource. It will suck out all the rare earth, it'll suck out everything. It will take everything from Myanmar. Okay. That's the idea.
All right, okay. Now, Mandalay, the earthquake, 5,000 dead, it was obviously devastating, horrific, great tragedy. Before the earthquake, the ethnic armed organisations, the EAOs, had surrounded Mandalay and laid siege to the place. They didn't want to mount a full-scale invasion of the old capital because they were fearful of what the junta might do and how it would react and the fallout on ordinary people. What is the situation now in Mandalay, given the earthquake, and where does it sit militarily?
Well, Mandalay, generally the earthquake, A lot of the aid, international aid, was funneled towards Naypyidaw.
Mm-hmm.
They want to rebuild Naypyidaw. There was a rumour that they would actually move the capital to Yangon because of the devastation in Naypyidaw, but they seem to be rebuilding it. So their focus is there. A lot of the aid has been prevented to get to Mandalay. Some has got there, but a lot has been prevented.
Right.
But you've got people working on the ground. So the People's Defence Forces. These people are there to defend the communities, but also they're supporting the communities.
Okay.
So they are working, doing aid work. They're supporting, getting food, reconstruction, everything there.
Is that
the big thing in Mandalay and Sagaing.
Right. Is that undermining the military's position in that region? What I'm getting at, could the EAO surreptitiously take Mandalay, Sagaing area simply because the military is not there and doing what it should be doing if it claims to be running Myanmar?
Well, a lot of Sagaing they don't control anyway.
Right.
As for Mandalay, I think it's certainly not until well after the monsoon will they try and take Mandalay. That is a big, big prize.
Okay, but
and they'll take other towns beforehand.
Right, but you're saying take Mandalay after the monsoon, which really suggests that Mandalay is probably gone at the moment. And as we both know, the military doesn't have a strong record on retaking anywhere in Myanmar since they mounted the offensive in November 2023.
How about last year with the Chinese support? They've taken, but interestingly with last year, they can't administer it. They can't do anything there. Crime is going through the roof. They can't control it. So they haven't got the means to actually administer anything they actually do take back, if they do take it back, even with outside support.
Well, that goes back to the old laws of war. Okay, you've invaded it. Now you've got it. What are you going to do with it? Which is a problem everybody, every nation has faced, like the Americans in more recent decades.
And the EAOs are doing that.
Okay.
So they're putting education, healthcare in, even when they're still getting airstrikes, they're doing this immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Even universities in Kareni State, they're putting everything in very, very fast.
Right.
They have got the ability, they have got the capacity to do that. The junta hasn't got that capacity.
Okay. Are they deploying the kind of the political agenda that the National Unity Government in exile keeps pushing? They want the EAOs to push their political agenda onto the people, but as we both know, they don't all get along, and it's not really a priority for those who have been fighting in the streets or in the jungles to implement the NUG's agenda.
Well, often you look at the KNU and KMPP, the Kareni.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their own governments. They've been working 60 years. They've got the healthcare system. They've got the education system.
Right.
They don't need the NUG for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they will want to stay semi-autonomous.
Right.
Semi-autonomous. Cooperating, but semi-autonomous. They're not going to just blindly follow the NUG. That's certainly not. There's a lot of criticism at the moment with the NUG. Like, NUG was going to have a big reform.
Yeah.
They talked about. You mentioned to any NUG person or any resistance person about NUG reform, they laugh.
Okay.
It's not going to happen. You know, they've got racists they need to get out. They've got inefficient people they need to get out. They need to make it more representative. It's not going to happen.
Well, it's not going to happen now, and it's a bit of a tall order given the war's still ongoing, perhaps afterwards, but
well, afterwards, what position is NUG going to be in? Because the EROs are the ones actually going to be actually winning the war.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be the strong ones. They're going to have a big say in that. And one thing they don't want is NUG, as in the Obama style, controlling the dry zone, controlling the middle, Naypyidaw,
right.
Mandalay, Yangon, etc. Sagaing, Magway, Northern Bagu. They don't want them controlling that.
Mm-hmm.
That's important.
It takes in a lot of Obama state.
Yeah.
The traditional heartland of the military.
Exactly. Now that,
yeah.
They're moving more into that area. So I think the planning,
mm-hmm.
speculation, is to have a Bama state with a Bama ERO controlling it.
Right. And that would
fit in with the other EROs.
Yeah, sure.
EAOs.
Now, we've spoken about this before, where the EAOs, EROs, different acronyms here, but
yeah.
It's the same thing, that they were looking at putting together a joint force from the different EAOs and using that to attack and move into Bama State. Is that what you're talking about, or is that proving unrealistic?
No, it isn't. It isn't unrealistic. You look at the American Army, mm-hmm. it's moving. Moving
right.
more into that area. They're very close to the, in Bagu State, there's 11 military arms factories,
yep.
just the other side of the Irrawaddy River. They're moving very close to that. And those factories are desperately producing weapons because they're running out.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, they're producing the weapons that people have found now,
yep.
or the weapons, the ammunition, is from 2025. That means their stocks are going down. So if they can start taking those arms factories, they're going to be in serious trouble.
Would the Arakan army cross the Irrawaddy River? I always get the impression that they kind of restrict themselves to west of that area, but it's a 52-card pickup now that all the cards are in the air.
No, I think they are moving. They are moving more out of Arakan,
right.
into the dry zone, into Irrawaddy. They're moving more and more, and they're winning, and they will go. They are going, obviously, towards the arms factories, and they mm-hmm. will take those arms factories sooner or later, I'm sure. Then you've got the KIA, which is moving in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got other groups like the Bama People's Liberation Army.
Right.
It's Bama. It's called Bama deliberately to show these are Bama people fighting against the Bama military.
Right.
They, I think, are going to be moving into the centre as well. So you have various moving into the centre, which is very important, because in the centre,
mm-hmm.
you have the People's Defence Forces, who are doing great work, but these are kids with very limited training. When I say kids, you know, I met a friend of mine, he joined when he was 16 years old. He lied about his age.
Yeah, I have to say, just for the audience's for a better idea, we are in Mae Sot, and I've been up here quite a few times over the last 2 years, and it always amazes me how many, I call them kids because I'm getting old, but 25-year-olds who I've met who have got a university degree and they were looking forward to a career in medicine, sciences, humanities, and now they've got 3-4 years combat experience and they've been kind of retired off. They've seen and done too much, and what you're saying is that the troops are getting younger and younger.
Well, this is an exception. He lied about his age. And
okay.
He left 2 years later, and now he's studying, thank goodness.
Still.
But that's why I'm calling them kids.
Right.
But you've got them, but they have limited training.
Yep.
They need to come under greater control.
Mm-hmm.
The NUG is not able to control its People's Defence Forces very well.
I'm under the impression that the PDFs, the People's Defence Force, was established by the NUG as their military contribution. But what I've gathered over the last couple of years is that the PDFs, they get into the jungles, they get into the fighting, they're often aligned with one of the EAOs, and their sympathies lie with the EAOs, not with the NUG.
There's a very positive thing in this as well,
yep.
because the EAOs didn't really have that much contact with the mm-hmm. Bama before. The Bama were like the enemy.
Yeah.
You know, Karen hated the Bama,
mm-hmm.
the people generally. There was a lot of discrimination against each other. Now, they'd be fighting with them.
Yeah.
And they're not going to allow different armed groups fighting in their area without their control. You look at the Karen National Liberation Army.
Yeah.
It all says KNLA plus Alliance.
Right.
This means the PDS fighting with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to let them fight all over the place. It's going to cause chaos.
Yeah.
So they have them together. They're beginning to coordinate as a gang, the Magway, but not enough. And they need greater direction, greater line of control, hierarchy, as in a military. That is obviously something the Arrows are talking about, and hopefully that will happen. When, I don't know. Maybe after the monsoon.
Okay. And then on top of the fighting, on top of the earthquake, we still have this issue with the human traffickers and the scam compounds. There was a crackdown initiated by the Thais with Chinese backing in February. It all seemed to be going really well, and they rescued 10,000 people thereabouts. And then the Mandalay earthquake happened and completely swept it off the international news agenda. It's just gone. It's like nothing happened. I was at a conference in Bangkok about a week ago, and Jason Tower was there from the United States Institute for Peace. And he was saying that 10,000 number is still the same 2 months later, and that only 9,000 of those 10,000 had actually been repatriated. I know you've been saying before that the biggest problem with the crackdown is it's just pushing the traffickers and the scam compounds further into Myanmar, and that's just going to make it a bit harder for any future crackdown and to stop these buggers from doing what they do.
I agree and disagree with a couple of things. I think the crackdown was initiated by the Chinese with Thai backing. The Thais wouldn't have done it without the Chinese.
Right.
The Chinese envoy went straight over there. You know, he was in control. It's very clear. It was Chinese. The Thais probably wouldn't have done too much. In fact, I suspect there's quite a few Thais that have been making quite a lot of profit out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese are interested in getting the Chinese out. They're not really interested in the others. You know, they want to control it. They don't want them to be too powerful because they're Chinese, like Yai Thai, a large mafia-type company. They don't want them to be too strong, but also they want the Chinese out, the Chinese scammers out. They get them straight out onto planes with computers, laptops, phones, straight back to China where they're interrogated and they have a massive information.
Pull everything apart and figure out what they've been doing and how they've been doing it.
And they've got all the information of various people around the world.
Sure.
So it's very, very useful for them. They've nearly got all their people out now.
Right.
They've nearly got all their people out. People still left there are from often from countries where the countries don't seem to be that interested.
Yeah, particularly the African countries. I think Jason Tower was saying that there are 39 countries involved in the compounds.
Yeah, and you've got maybe more, but like Ethiopians, they got out about 10 days ago.
Right.
But that they were there, and you've got one of the militia that's looking after them and that runs some of the, or gives security for some of these scam compounds like DKPA. They were saying, we want money to feed them. We've had them here for more than a month.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to feed them, and the countries aren't taking them out. Now, China, I think business is almost finished as far as China's concerned. It's under control. They've got the Chinese out. And also, they've got a joint operations office in Aesop for anti-trafficking. Like, some sceptics will say that that office with the Chinese right on the border in Myanmar is more than to stop
anti-trafficking. It's a hell of a listening post.
Exactly. That is the speculation.
Yeah.
So, and they've been wanting this for a while. So the Chinese have finished. So they've finished. The scam compounds, they haven't changed. You go and look at Swakopo, etc.
Yeah.
KK Park. You look at them, they haven't changed. They've actually got more construction. They're building more there. So on the border they're building, they're also in Yangon. They're all over the place. They're also in Cambodia. There's an upsurge again.
Yeah.
So they are moving, but they're not moving from the border either. They're not leaving those assets. They're still there. They're still working. They won't target so many Chinese now, because of their problem, although they have got Chinese speakers from Myanmar, from near the border, the Kokang. They will probably target more Africans, South Americans, etc. Probably not so many Thais either, because that could be a bit of a backlash against them again. But they're going to broaden their geographic scope.
Westerners? Westerners?
Oh, they've been targeting Westerners.
I realise that, but...
And China doesn't care if they're targeting Americans, of course. They'd be quite happy with that.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting one. But I do get the impression that a lot of this, the crackdown, even if you take it way back to when it first started in Cambodia, there's a bit of an issue over who actually broke this story first. But to my mind, it was when Asian governments started writing to the Cambodian government saying, what's going on here? Because it was their nationals that were being duped and trafficked, and then their nationals were targeting their own people for scams because they speak the same language. And often with these scammers, I mean, I've had them myself on my own phones, and that their English is just shoddy and they don't know how to do it really. And that's why I'm wondering what their target audience will be. And I think a lot of it goes back to what country these people who are working in these compounds, where they come from.
I agree. With Cambodia, of course, it was the Chinese police.
Yes, it was.
One of the big people closing it down. But now, remember, they've got AI. They've got top people there. You've got Westerners there. People have seen Westerners.
Yeah, I've heard about Americans working for the compounds. In
They're producing clever apps.
Right.
So with AI, clever apps and things like that, you don't have to say anything. It can actually be computerized. And then you put a pretty face at the end.
Wow, I mean, if you're going to fall for that these days, you almost deserve to. Touch wood.
I'm not bailing you out.
Well, it goes back to, the early days of the internet and email, when we were all receiving emails from, hi, I'm a Nigerian and I'm coming to 20... I inherited $22 million and I don't know what to do with it. Can I borrow your bank account for a while?
Exactly. But no, people are still being fooled. They aim at the elderly. And it's called pig butchering. They bring them in slowly, and they get some profit, and then they get them into cryptocurrency, and they bring them in until the time is bang, and the money's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a slow... It can take months to bring them in. And they're bringing in... They bought in an American CEO.
Right.
He lost about $50 million.
Oh my God, that's a haul.
But of course, the scammer gets a percentage of that. So scammers can make very good money.
Another quick question on, we'll get back to the NUG and the politics shortly, but I do wonder how much of this money is actually going into government coffers, which is alleged. So there was a report by Jacob Sim, who's pretty well known, that was released last week, and it's all about the ruling elites in Cambodia, and they are apparently making squillions out of the scam compounds. I kind of have my doubts about these reports, because my understanding is that it's digital money, and this digital money is being shipped offshore. Massive amounts. There's not even any cash. Now, yes, I'm sure the politicians are raking an income out of this, but I sort of doubt the amount of money they're actually getting. One of the reasons why is because the economies across the region are in dreadful shape. And one of the reasons why is there's a lack of money. And if they were raking in the amount of money that some of these reports seem to be suggesting, it wouldn't be that bad. There's no money going through the general economy.
But it's going to be...
And I doubt how much money these politicians are getting as well.
We don't know. But for the scam compounds to actually run on the border, for people to be trafficked, or even voluntarily come in, and most of volunteers are coming in and then going across the border, going through all the checkpoints, all the rest of it, someone high up was taking a big backhander to let that happen.
I'm sure they are, but I just wonder how much, because I doubt very much whether or not it's... I'm sure it's a significant figure, but I think the sheer amount of money that's going through these compounds...
Billions of dollars.
Extraordinary.
No, of course it isn't. It's all been put all over the place in secure places, in cryptocurrency.
It also goes back to the argument whether or not... these governments have control over their state, or whether or not they're becoming a captured state to the criminal syndicates.
I don't know if they've become a captured state insofar, but I think it's more that top people in power can be bought off. They can be bought off, and I think they've been bought off. That's why just after the first scam compound, which was Choket, that compound, which was a nasty one, a lot of people got brutalised there. There was a plane, a friend of mine was on the plane, full of Chinese, flying out of Mae Sot. And they told me these people didn't have scars, didn't have bruises, they had plastic surgery, they were crude, they were swearing, they were laying across the seats, and they were getting out. Why did they get out? No, and the Chinese weren't taking them back to China. This was to get them out because they knew too much.
Right.
And you've got this as well. So nothing's going to happen. Also, interesting, BGF some months ago...
As in the Border Guard Force, which is a militia with an odd relation to the junta in Myanmar, and its main job is to guard the borders.
Yes, yeah. It's a bit of a mafia organisation, to be honest. Mm. Still giving money to the junta, but they months ago they promised that they wouldn't be taking any more trafficking victims, and only probably a couple of weeks ago, the other militia there, there's the two, the BGF, Border Guard Force, and the DKPA, the other militia, they said they will not be taking any trafficked people.
Right.
So they're only going to take people who voluntarily come, and there's enough of them anyway.
Okay.
So then that means they've said we're not trafficking anyone. So they've taken that out of the equation.
Right, that makes it all okay.
For some, it does.
Well, yeah. I've heard this argument about the people who run these scam compounds, how their idea is that we're not trafficking anymore, therefore what we're doing is okay. And it's like, hang on, you can't legitimise a business based on ripping off, you know, the pension funds of old people. What are you talking about? But anyway.
I know.
Okay, so all of this, we were talking earlier about the NUG and the politics of the NUG is, it's getting complex.
Well, there was supposed to be some while ago NUG reform, mm-hmm. which is a joke and everyone laughs about it.
Yeah, you mentioned that
earlier. As I mentioned, NUG has a few problems. For example, you've got the Rohingya. The Rohingya still haven't got citizenship.
Yep. And that goes back to 1982.
Yeah, right. Their citizenship law 1982.
And that was a law that the NUG holds on to, which doesn't... that goes back to the census, which doesn't recognise the Rohingya, and the NUG is maintaining that stance.
I wouldn't say they're not maintaining the stance. They say it will be reformed, be changed. Right. But it hasn't yet.
Okay.
It hasn't. And they keep making excuses and saying it's not been changed because we need the National Union Consultative Council to be involved, we need other people, we need to talk to all the EAOs, we need to talk to them all before we make that sort of decision, and it's complicated because the 1982 law is, we need to change 50% of it, so let's wait until we've got a constitution and etc. So they're basically prevaricating, and in my opinion, that's not the job of a government. The job of the government is to make some hard decisions based on principles and morality. And obviously, the Rohingya, and it's not just Rohingya, it's Nepali, Rohingya, Indian and Chinese, they should have their citizenship reinstated. They can do that. They have changed some articles that are in the constitution already. Yep. So they managed to do that, but they haven't changed this. And and they seem to be blaming others. And because a lot of Myanmar, because of indoctrination for a long time, and lack of education, let's be honest, are perhaps racist or anti-Rohingya. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this myself even here. Because of this, they're pandering to the mass.
Yeah,
and that's not their job. Their job is to take a moral stance.
What you're saying and how you're describing the NUG is reminiscent of their leader who is in prison, Aung San Suu Kyi, and how she just seemed to whitewash the alleged genocide of the Rohingya back in 2017. It was these constant excuses about why they can't be recognised. They're not Myanmar citizens. They're not welcome. It kind of smacks.
And she said things were exaggerated. She said there's false rape and things like that.
And she defended the military in an international court.
Exactly. I think well before there, she put all her cards with the military.
Sure.
She should have put them with the ethnic resistance, organisations, or the ethnic organisations, and the civil society. She should have put it there. Those are the people, her natural allies. She thought her allies, and she could work with the military.
Right.
So she'd already put her cards, or her eggs in that basket, rather. So then,
the NUG is following... Well, it's impossible to follow that line. Obviously, we're in civil war now, but in terms of that kind of, it's not a policy, but that political line that she maintained, her political compadres in the NUG continuing to follow.
Well, I think talking to some NUG, they defend her. They defend her greatly on this. Some would like to see it changed, but it's not changing. I think it's a mixture between cowardice and racism in the NUG. It's a mixture too. You've got some definite racists. Definitely well-proven racist there, still there. And it's also cowardice. They don't want to actually do it because they think there could be a backlash by the people of Myanmar.
Okay.
I think this is the right moral thing to do. It's a principled thing to do. They're just showing cowardice.
Right. Now, just quickly, we are running out of time. I think the last time we spoke, your estimate was that the military was in absolute control of perhaps 15% of the country, 55% thereabouts belonged to the EAOs, PDFs, NUG, I'll throw them into the mix to keep them happy, and the rest was being fought over. Has that changed?
No, I don't think that's really changed.
Still roughly the same?
Roughly the same. They're still controlling the main towns, but 90 towns have been taken. Mm-hmm. We forget that. It's not just rural. 90 towns plus two military regional command centres have been taken by the resistance.
So what we're looking
And they're
at...
taking more and more and more.
Okay. So what we're looking at isn't necessarily territorial gains anymore. What we're looking at is fighting over the bigger towns, the smaller cities, and arms bases, and where the goodies are, that kind of
and the mop, they're
more
mop,
targeted.
Yeah, the Mopit. Well, at the moment, Bamu is a big,
right,
significant place that they're fighting over. The resistance doing quite well, but a hell of a lot of airstrikes there. You look at the border with Thailand, the Karenni and the Karen. They're mopping up everything. They're controlling nearly all the border. They're talking about having customs and immigration because they're controlling the border. There's only one or two military outposts to take, and they will take them soon. Every day they're fighting and taking them.
Right.
So they'll control all of that. They are getting more territory. They're not taking the bigger cities.
Right, we're not talking about territory like we were a year ago where, you know, they're taking 10% of the country, 20%. Mm. Or another 5%. Those days are over. What we're looking at is the key strategic cities, towns, and military bases. That's what it's about now.
Yes.
All right. On that note, Paul Greeny, always great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
And always not enough time. But yeah, nice
talking to you. I understand what you're saying. You've always got damn sight more to say than the time I have been allotted.
And can I apologise for that, Luke?
No, no need. Thoroughly enjoyed. Thanks, mate.
Okay, cheers.